You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
You're not in Hauraki. Don't worry, you're on BFM.
You're listening to Audio Culture. I'm here with Gareth Shute. We're talking about your article, The Rock and Roll Revival of the Early 2000s.
Yeah, we were talking off air about how Martin Pepperell did a nice thing the last Audio Culture session about his article on new soul and those cool new jazz influenced acts. And so I thought it ruined the vibe by coming in and talking about early 2000s rock and roll.
Well, it's all kind of related, you know, like these trends that kind of come in and out of style. But I feel like a lot of people, I mean, the first thing that I thought when I read this was it's like, did rock and roll ever actually go out of style? Like, did it have to be revived? Did it die?
No, that's a funny thing. I mean, especially if you talk to someone like John Baker, who's been pushing it for decades in New Zealand, like touring bands and helping young bands. He definitely sees it as just a straight line from the late 50s right through the 60s, 70s, 80s. Yeah. That's kind of why I started the article with one of his compilations where he put all those threads together just to make the point, oh, even though we're talking about a revival, it's kind of like, it's just a refreshing of rock and roll that comes and the early 2000s one was just a reaction to the 90s, which was like dance music was so big in Auckland in the 90s. Like dance parties could fill this whole town hall or St. James, like, the, you know. And so it was the perfect time for this kind of rock to come back. Mm. I mean, the previous one wasn't that long ago. Like early 90s, you had the grunge thing, but grunge so quickly turned into like live and all these kind of whiny sort of. Pearl Jam had a lot to answer for, I think, because that sort of vocal style went, kind of like emotional, slightly slower rock music.
Yeah.
Kind of ruined rock for a little while there. But yeah, I mean, and the reason why we started with the Datsuns was they were just so emblematic, and they sort of traversed this sort of moment in time from the beginning right through the end, because they were right there at the beginning, like, in a way. There were in Auckland, there was a Frisbee Leisure Lounge, which was this space really that was run by Bob Frisbee. There was just a lot of cheap areas around town at that time where you could like rent these places. This one used to be a bank, and because they were going to demolish it, he could just like rent it for a year and set up a studio there. So that's how these bands like the D4 and the Rainy Days kind of got the scene started. And with John Baker touring these bands as well, like the Helicopters, the Swedish band that were trying to bring that sort of classic rock back. And he did the Dead Moon before that and stuff. And that sort of started building the scene. So even a band like the Datsuns, who were like down in Cambridge, and they were originally playing as Trinket, and it was a lot more sort of straightforward rock. They got to see the Helicopters come on tour, and then they got to, like, Dolph Datsun would drive up to the Frisbee Leisure Lounge shows and stuff, and really got that energy. And because it was all ages as well, it was like, I mean, up till 99, the drinking age was 20, so it was a different scene. Like, if you were 18, 19, that's where you had to see a band.
Yeah, it's kind of all those things that you don't really think about, but it's like the cross-pollination of touring and the different venues and stuff. I mean, I feel like when I think of, like, rock and roll and, like, New Zealand rock, I definitely, my mind immediately goes to, like, Flying Nun and, like, the Dunedin sound. But I really found it interesting the different corners that you kind of dive into in terms of, like, the Christchurch scene and, like, also what was happening in Tamaki Makaurau, like, during the 90s and the 2000s and how that all kind of started.
Yeah, you had people like High Tone Destroyers and that whole scene with Celia, who was later in King Loser and stuff, in Christchurch. And then in Wellington you had Andrew Tolley, who had like Hasselhoff Experiment and ran his own label and so forth. But even Flying Nun, that's the hilarious thing at that time, you know, it was just a sub-label of Festival Mushroom Records, and their big acts were the D4, Betcha Duper, which is Liam Finn's rock band, and like Pan Am. They were like totally getting on this hype cycle as well, trying to do rock bands. So that's why I like Phoenix Foundation. I talked to Sam about this once, and he said the reason why Phoenix Foundation released their first album through FMR, but they didn't put it on Flying Nun because it was like, but we're not a rock band. At the moment, that's kind of what the label's about. So you'd think they would be the perfect Flying Nun act.
Right.
And they did later. But yeah, moving on, I mean, what happened really, though, was Datsuns arrived at a perfect time in England when they did go over. You know, they got there just at the moment when John Peel was still really influential as a DJ, and they managed to get him a song. And I guess it was just those bands were coming over from America and stuff. You had like the White Stripes and things and the Strokes, so they were just on the cusp of that. And NME, the big magazine there, like, was really excited, and they had their own sort of bands, the Pete Doherty sort of early bands and stuff. And so they arrived at this perfect time. And so it's crazy to think that that song Motherfucker From Hell was like, even though obviously couldn't get played on radio, their first single, In Love, went to like top 20. But even Motherfucker From Hell, which couldn't get played on the radio, went top 50, you know, and they had their album in the top 20. So it was this crazy time, and it really fueled this energy back home that started all these other bands. So like another band I wanted to play was the Rainy Days, who are this other band that was out of the Frisbee set. And I guess the interesting thing, I mean, it is a real boyish scene, and I don't think these days it would be like that. But Rainy Days were this amazing band that were half two female musicians, a drummer and a bassist, and two male musicians. And
that's what we like to hear.
Yeah, yeah. And run by Dave Graham, who's like a you know, Bob Frisbee always says he's just one of the biggest geniuses from that scene. Like, they would just go in the other room and say, oh, I've thought of an idea for a song, and he'd come back like 1 minute later and he'd written this whole amazing song.
Wow.
But he was, he thought very differently than other people, so I don't know how there wasn't much chance of him making a big career of it. But these two Rainy Days albums are pretty amazing. And if you have listened to this song, the things to listen out for are the interesting use of saxophone rather than guitar, and also that in the breakdown they use a ping pong table percussion on it. So have a listen to that.
Love that. This is Swing That Thing from the Rainy Days. That ping pong ball is so good.
So cunning. Yeah, I think John Baker played that. They just, I don't know how they got it in time, but I guess Bob Frisbee just sort of waited for the right moment and
a delicate
it up.
Art, the ping pong percussion, you know.
Yeah.
And the sax as well, it just adds such a nice texture.
Yeah, there were so many cool bands that came out of that Frisbee thing. Like Rock and Roll Machine was another one that did quite well. Like Karen from Rainy Days was the bass player, and some of the old drummers from D4 in it and stuff. Obviously the big band that came out was the D4 themselves, though. They also became massive through their connections through Flying Nun. They like could use connections with Mushroom, who owned Flying Nun in the UK, to get deals. And they were like the guy who started Creation Records and was their manager and stuff, and it seemed like Paul McGuinness, I think. And so they were like going to be big in their US deal. One of the guys from Flying Nun once told me that that was the biggest deal in terms of money that a Flying Nun act ever got. So they got all this money behind them, and it was like, you know, people in the UK loved the D4 just as much as the Datsun, and it seemed like they were going to be big. But actually, it's trouble with big record deals. You know, Jimmy Christmas once told me that they, you know, they went on tour with the Von Bondies and these other bands that were cooler than them in America. And then they turned up to this venue. I think I say in the article on Audio Culture, they turned up to a venue and it just had posters all along the wall of just the D4. And the other bands were like, you're the support act, like this.
Yeah.
And they were just so embarrassed. And it was like, oh, that's. And when you sign a deal and you get a big advance like that, it's your money you're kind of spending. Like it's all coming out of the profits that the album will make. So in a way, it was their money that was paying for this dumb marketing that they never would have approved of. But yeah, So I think people enjoy that article in the Audio Culture because it does kind of show how that rock and roll revival was one moment in time where Enemy was really excited. But in a way, even the D4, when they arrived in America, and the Datsuns even, it was almost passé there because the Strokes and the White Stripes had already been big. And so they actually got terrible reviews and Pitchfork and stuff. And they were even meaner to the other bands that came later. Like, I remember Jet from Australia.
Yeah.
They were terrible, like, trying to be retro rock, but a lot more middle of the road. But the review on Pitchfork was just an embedded video of a monkey masturbating was the review.
No. Yeah. Oh, my
gosh. Yeah, so it got pretty harsh. But yeah. So a lot of other bands came through. Like, there was a whole, like, Czech scene on the North Shore that I talk about as well. That was amazing. They had like their own festival over there, and those guys are still going, doing racing and stuff. Mm-hmm. And bands like The Have and stuff that were going to be the next big thing, but just the time it takes to record an album, you know, the Czechs and The Have, they couldn't.
It's hard to like keep up with the trends when it's taking that long to record stuff and make it. And I guess that's the thing with like having a revival. It's like, if you're, and that's telling of the like overseas receival of like D4 and those guys, is like, if you're not actually adding much new, then it's not going to be received that well.
If people have already revived it, it's kind of like, oh, but someone's revived it already, we're on to
the
next
thing. How many times can you revive something before it's old?
That's why I like the thread of Pip Brown starting her career at being like the guitarist in Tulane Blacktop, who are one of those garage bands who did the same thing as these other bands, put out a 7-inch record before anything else and had a label looking at them in the US and stuff. But they broke up, so she ended up going to Australia by herself and started Lady Hawk and went in that 80s synth direction.
Yeah.
And so by the time she got to the UK, everyone was like, we're into synth now, you're the new thing. And she like blew up instead, and all those rock bands were passé.
Wow.
But I guess the nice thing to reflect on to finish, I mean, people should go on Audio Culture and check out that article.
It is a great article.
I think you'll enjoy the story. But I think the funny thing to reflect on is that those people are still going. Bob Frisbee still has a studio, and he's been recording with Princess Chelsea, and he does stuff with the Beths and stuff. He's done sound for them touring in Australia and been the sound man for Princess Chelsea in the US. And John Baker, this very night, he's doing a launch party for a book about the Beatles called When
Big
We Were
Fan.
Fab. Yeah. At Big Fan.
Big Fan, in Morningside.
Yeah, so keep an eye out for When We Were Fab, if you're interested in the Beatles in New Zealand and that bit of history. But I thought to finish, we could just listen to the D4. I really like, this is like their last song, and it's so sad. It's like, I feel like it's their best song in a way. But it came out, you know, they'd gone through this whole thing with these record labels dumping them and being like, oh, no, it's too late. And Paul McGuinness, the creation guy, he was like, I still love you guys, and he put it out on 7-inch and stuff. So it was this kind of statement piece for them. And they went from touring in buses to just touring in a van and going with the Hives all around Europe and stuff.
Wow.
But the song just couldn't quite take off in the pre-internet days. But I think it's a great way to remember them by.
Cool. Thank you so much, Gareth Shoot, for talking with us on Audio Culture today about the revival of rock and roll in the early 2000s.
Thanks, Rosetta.
This is the D4 with What I Want. Thank you, Audio Culture.
Should I get up? Sleep all day? Answer the call? Let the telephone ring? Sit in silence? Turn the radio on? Find somebody to talk to?
That was
Audio Culture on 95 BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just